I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, welcome to And the Writer Is. I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. For a little bit of context, we just wanted you to know that a lot of these were recorded before quarantine. And as we know, a lot has changed in 2020. So again, please stay safe out there and enjoy the new episodes of And the Writer Is. This podcast is brought to you by CSAC, an industry leader and innovator in music performance licensing. For over 80 years, CSAC has established strong relationships in the creative community by investing in the careers of its top-tier affiliated songwriters and film and TV composers. To learn more about CSAC and its affiliated relationships with songwriters and composers, visit CSAC.com/origins to learn more. Again, visit CSAC.com/origins. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's multi-Grammy winning, multi-platinum selling songwriter producer didn't just define legendary artist careers, but literally brought sexy back. This CSAC Songwriter of the Year, of which he was crowned three times, has influenced pop music for almost 20 years, as evidenced in every vocal chop since Britney Spears' Gimme More. Steering the sound of some of the biggest records to start this century, this protege-turned-master has spanned multiple genres, with classic names highlighted in his discography like Bjork, Nelly Furtado, and The Game. Even in the recession of the late 2000s, this writer's catalog sold over 100 million songs. From Virginia Beach, Virginia, this guy has a hit sound of his own, and the writer is Nate Danger Hills.
Ew. Man, that was awesome.
Yeah, well, you know.
That was great.
That's why I get paid the average bucks.
I need that walking into the studio.
Yeah.
That, like, just charged me.
We need to have that bullseye.
Right. Exactly.
And have the spotlights while you walk in.
I'm making that. I'm going to send that to you.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
You do that. I will do everything I can to post that to my very few followers. So let's start from the beginning, man. I mean, you know, I have so many questions, but the first thing is, why is it that every good songwriter is from Virginia? What is it about Virginia?
Everybody. So I've been trying to figure out how to bottle up some type of water from Virginia and sell it, because that's the number one question is, what's in the water in Virginia? I don't know, man. I think...
But it's not just good writers. I mean, it's... You know, it's Missy and Pharrell, but it's Benny and it's Amar, mm-hmm. and it's J Cash, and it's, yeah. There's so many. There's just the list, right, of Virginia influencers in music is insane.
I can't say what it is. I can't put my finger on it, but I know that there's not a lot of opportunity. And there's not a lot of inspiration. So we kind of have to go deep within to find something. And out of boredom and lack of opportunity and places to go and things to do, We listen to a lot of music, and there's a lot of, we listen, everything comes to Virginia. So we like in the middle, we're in the bottom of the north, but the top of the south. And we hear music from everywhere, from the west, go-go, house, New York, the south. We hear it from all over the place. So we just take this gumbo and chop it up and make this refined thing and turn it into our own thing.
It's crazy, man.
But everything is, you know, I think a lot of these guys, like myself, Tim, Pharrell, we all have this super rhythmic thing with us. And I guess that would be the go-go feeling.
Well, tell me about your childhood. How did you, you know, what was it like growing up in Virginia Beach? And we were just talking, we're pretty much the same age. You grew up the same era. So right. What's it like growing up in Virginia Beach in the 80s?
I feel like, I was in a small neighborhood, very small neighborhood, Friendship Village. Shout out to anybody who hears that. My father and my mom, they kept me in church and kept me out the street and kept me in sports and just kept me busy. So my lifestyle growing up was just church, basketball practice, home, school, you know.
Church.
Basketball practice or football practice or baseball practice, whatever it was. And but my dad would play gospel in the house, jazz in the house.
Did he actually play it or he'd play records?
No, he just would play records, just his favorites. Yeah. But he would blast it all day long. Like, we would be asleep and he would crank it, like waking us up to music. So,
did anybody else play music in the house? Actually, you know, play instruments?
I think all of my brothers and sisters have some sort of musical talent. Mm-hmm. My parents don't. My mom has a beautiful voice. My dad can, you know, he'll hit you with a rap or something every now and then. Like, he was just good at being creative on the spot. And you just helped me realize that. He, like, really on the fly would just bust out with a little rhyme or joke or something, like, really quick, all the time. So I guess that's where my quick, you know, thinking quick on the go creatively comes from. But all my brothers and sisters have some sort of musicality. Like, my little sister sings. I have a brother who rap, and he make tracks, and he's very raw. He also was playing around with a little bit of bass and drum. We all can hop on drums. I have three brothers. Even my sister can hop on drums, and she play a little bit of keys. So I don't know where it came from. We was like a mini Jackson 5.
Did you guys actually play music together?
We didn't play together, really. Mm. We were just singing the choir, you know.
Yeah. My dad's at church?
Yeah, at my dad's church. It would be, you know, us playing the music and singing.
Yeah. When you say your dad's church, was he a preacher?
Yes, he still is, and he has ministries in Africa and El Salvador, I think, and at home in Virginia. And, I grew up in church. He started his own ministry, and then we started playing music for his church.
Drums is really your first instrument, mm-hmm, right? Not piano, mm-hmm. But you play piano too.
Yeah.
So was this just one of those things where you just would walk behind a drum kit and just knew how to play?
It was literally that. Like,
that's so annoying, man.
It was the guy. No, man.
That is so annoying. It's so hard to fathom just looking at it. It seems so easy until you realize how not easy it is.
I was just so intrigued by the instrument, and I had it in me. I just had to sit down and try it. But it was a guy in church who just looked like he hated, like he hated playing. Like, he just looked like he hated playing. He was playing for his father's church.
Yeah.
And I was just like, if you don't want to play so bad, just let me play, like, please. And
how
I didn't
old
know.
Were you at that
I was
point?
12. I was 12. And we would go hop on it after church when it's over until they kick us off. And that would be my little 5 minutes of practice time to see if I can get it. But I was literally just watching him. And then he didn't show up for church. He might have been sick. That was my time. So I hopped on the set. And I was playing in church for a few years, and I really started getting good. And another musician came. He would show me things and take me to another drummer that I know very well. And he would show me things, and I started to develop as a drummer. And I swear, like, right when I was getting good and really feeling confident, my dad started his own ministry and snatched me up off the drums, and I had to play keys, and I was just...
Were you bummed about that?
Bummed.
Why?
Because I really felt like I was becoming a drummer and things was locking in and clicking for me. Like, I remember my development. And I just loved drums. Like, my dad brought me a drum set. Couldn't afford it, but he found one for $100 in a pawn shop. He put it in our apartment in the corner of the kitchen. We making all type of noise. The neighbors hate it. They stomping on the roof. Like, you know, telling us to shut up. And that was the one good thing, that he fed whatever my interests were.
When did you start getting introduced to secular music, to just, you know?
When I was really young, I remember he would sneak a little bit in the car. Like, it might be the radio. He would play something every now and then. But then, you know, as we got older, he got deeper into the church. It just became primarily more gospel. Definitely, you know, no hip-hop, a little splash of R&B maybe every now and then, or one of his old-time favorites or something. But then, you know, you know, we didn't have what the kids have today with streaming services, iPads, phones, and we can't just sneak off and listen on our own. But however we was able to get a tape or listen to the radio, I would listen to a lot of radio, you know, obviously before they got home from work or whatever. And I would be recording and making my little mixtapes of my favorite stuff. And
what were you listening to?
I mean, everything. Like,
is that? I mean, I guess at our age, we were talking about, you're probably starting, and at 12 or something, so it's early 90s kind of thing. It's
it was Dr. Dre at that point. It was Snoop. I remember jumping on the bed when Snoop was watching the dog. One of the videos, and Snoop was on the handlebars coming down the street. Mm. I remember that clear. I just remember being swept by this sound from, you know, the West. But obviously, things on the East Coast, everything, Daz Effects, we would watch the videos. When I say everything, I mean everything. Rakim, all the hip-hop, Chubb Rock,
Feel like you have sort of the trifecta of things that make good producers that we've talked to so far. One is you're from Virginia. One is that you're a drummer. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that that you played in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things seem to be often a lot of really good drummers become really good producers.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that you guys do in Virginia. And then whatever you learn in church.
Yeah.
Who teaches you how to play piano? Or did you just also look at a piano and you're like, oh, I hate that I have to do this, and you just picked it up?
Well, this,
or did you actually have to practice?
Okay, let me give you the piano story. So I had, so drums was at 12.
Uh-huh.
My dad brought my first keyboard at like 9. But I was like, you know, just playing with it. And instantly I was looking for a record button. Instantly, like, how do you record? Like, I remember holding it and looking at it like, how do you record this thing? It did have a record button, but I don't even know what it recorded, you know what I mean?
Maybe so I'll give you like 10 seconds of recording.
Yeah, 10 seconds of something. I don't even know. Like a little beat that's already pre-programmed.
Yeah. Right.
So the melody was in me. I could find it, you know. I would go to a keyboard and just find it. Then eventually, you know, playing songs that I heard on the radio, I was just start finding it. And this is what it sound like, and put it together. And learn songs over and over again. So I developed my ability to play by learning songs for church that we had to sing. So just playing my ear, like, okay, let me retrace this chord. And this, like, I would hear every note and just chord by chord, learn it, play it over and over again. And in the process of learning it, I would stumble across things that wasn't in it, a new voicing or whatever. I'm like, oh, they didn't do that, but I hear this. And so what I was playing in church was not traditional chord progression. Yeah. I was playing what I wanted to play. Like, I would play what I wanted to play.
Did people like that?
I think I think they were into it. You know, I would throw them off every now and then, like, but I'm like, the melody works. Don't worry about it.
And you're like winking at everybody. Like, you see, hear that? Right. Check that in for sure.
Exactly.
Who gets you into recording? When was the first time you went into a studio?
Let me see. Okay, it's defined studio.
I don't know. I don't even, you know, I mean, I used a Tascam 4-track. Thing okay. Where you had to put, you know, whatever cassette, and then you'd have to marry the tracks, and I mean, it was...
Okay, my first recording experience where I kind of constructed something to record with was obviously the one radio, stereo, with a cassette with another one, and you play one to the other one. So that's how I made my first track. I would play the beat in the speaker.
When you play a beat, literally play it drums?
It was a pre-programmed beat. So I probably play the pre-programmed beat, but it
from
also had
synthesizer?
Drum sound. Yeah, yeah. From like, I don't even know where this thing come from.
Sure.
My dad had a little keyboard. I don't even know where it came from. But it had a dope kick and snare on it. I remember that. And I would just play my own rhythm to a pre-programmed track. Then I would record that to the tape, play that tape back, play my bass line or whatever, record those to another tape, flip. So it was so much hiss.
Sure. By the time it's done,
it's like, exactly. You can't even hear nothing. But I'm holding the tape in the air like I got a beat. And then I worked at Burger King for a year to save up for...
How old were you at this point?
I was 16, maybe
17. Yeah.
And I wanted my own. I went in the Radio Shack and I seen a Casio keyboard that has 6 tracks that you can record. And I was like, this is it. It was $350. You know, my mom couldn't afford it then. So I was instantly, I get a job. Like, I gotta have this. So, okay, then I started making tracks. By this time, I was super influenced by Tim.
Yeah.
And just all I wanted to do was make Timbaland beats. And fast forward from the 6-track sequencer, I left a tape on one of my first managers, who became one of my first managers. I left some beats on his voicemail. And he called me back and was like, yeah, come down to my studio.
In Virginia?
In Virginia, yeah.
How'd you get the guy's number?
It was from another friend from school. He was like, you know, I met this guy who's starting a
did he manage
label.
He had
a label, so he had artists.
Yeah.
So I was literally, my first experience during high school was producing tracks for multiple artists of different styles. So I haven't been doing anything that I haven't been doing since 18 years old now.
Yeah.
So I was making music for an R&B group, a girl group. I was making solo music for a rapper. I was making music for a rap group.
Did you have access then to his studio? Did he ever give you
that? It was his studio,
yeah.
It was his studio that had like cakewalk.
When you first walked in there, but of course you, I'm sure, didn't even have to look up anything because that's how you learned how to play everything else. But you walk into the studio, you know, first time anybody walks into a studio and you're a musician, you want to be a musician. It feels like a church.
it feels magical. Right.
You know, who's showing you around? Are you just immediately turning on synths? No. Just like, check this out. And then
he had a Trinity keyboard. You remember that? Korg Trinity. This was the one that Rodney Jerkins killed. So if you ever had a Trinity, you can listen, you can just go through the patches and you'll hear every Swiss Beat record and Destiny Child record that came out in the late 90s, 2000s. So instantly, I sat down on that thing and I just would play things and I instantly felt like, man, this sound like it could be on the radio, like instantly. Yeah. Just because of the sound quality. I think my ability was still raw and rough, but, you know, I'm going to jump forward, and then we're going to go back. But, like, when I met Tim, one of the first things, this was when I was 20, the first time I met him, and he was like, yo, you don't need anything but sounds. Like, I have, of course, he started talking about he have all the best sounds in the world. You don't need anything but sounds. Like, you got it. You just need the sounds. And so that reminds me of, you know, 2-3 years prior to where I hopped on this Trinity keyboard and instantly felt like the sound quality was so much better with what I was dealing with a Casio, obviously, that it felt like my quality went up, you know, immediately. But the guy who I sent the tape to was the guy who showed me around, like, yo, this is the Triton, this is how you use it. He wasn't necessarily a producer, but he just knew enough. He showed me Cakewalk, this is how you record. This
What's
is how
his
you...
name?
His name is Tommy Eaton.
Do you still keep in touch with him?
I spoke to him not long ago. Yeah. He worked for me for a little bit. And, yeah, you know, I felt like I had to give him a shot once I got a little further in my career. But he was the first guy who acknowledged the talent and helped try to cultivate it with his facility. You know, just gave me the open room and let me do my thing.
Were you, you know, if you're 16, 17, 18 years old at this point, did you finish school?
Yeah.
And then did you just work 90-hour weeks afterwards? Did you try, like, what is the life after, you know, you get into the studio, you have use of all this equipment, you've got these artists coming in, you know, it's not, were these artists getting released nationally? Were there any of them on majors, or is it all regional stuff?
It's all regional.
You know, like, did any of it end up becoming big even in DC or anything, or was it just sort of cutting your teeth on
this
stuff?
Just cutting my teeth. Just, I'm just happy to be in there collaborating with people. I was always collaborating with a lot of people.
When you say collaborating, like, as on just, the beat or
just
on the song?
Just on the song.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the beat. I would do the beat.
Yeah.
And we would just try to, you know, write to it, come up with raps and songs and whatever, with a lot of different people all the time. So by the time I got to him, I was already with the homies in school making songs.
Can you sing?
I can sing enough.
Yeah.
I can sing enough to say, no, this is how you need to do it.
Are you a good lyricist?
Not quite. I wouldn't say, it would take me time.
Yeah.
Like, to sit down and know what I want to say. But I, my process, I don't know if we're going to talk about this later, but what I like to do is give everybody the space to write, right? So a lot of times I'm writing or working with a writer and a lyricist. So maybe one may be stronger with melody than the other. And I might come up with some chords and they start doing their thing. I get them time to come up with what they want to come up with, but once they lay down some dummy melodies or whatever, then I can rearrange. No, this is what I feel like needs to happen. Or if they get stuck on a lyric, I say it this way instead of that way. So I kind of conduct the flow of the entire song versus specifically working on lyric or specifically working on melody. Like, I'm going to do the music bit and collaborate with the writers or artists to, you know, come up with the best song.
Was there ever a song in that era, the pre-Tim era, that you were like, this is huge. This is better than everything I'm listening to on the radio. Was there ever a song where you were like, you kind of outdid where you were at? You know, or were you always, this isn't good enough, this isn't good enough?
That's an interesting question. I'm super critical even now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, even back then I was still hard on myself.
Why?
It was something I was just trying to achieve that, you know, I was trying to match what I would hear on the radio or hear on albums or, you know, Tim was my biggest influence. I can't get around that. So anything he would come up with, I would be trying to beat in some way or another, stylistically with the track or with the song. And, but yeah, of course I came away with some things that I thought was amazing. But it, you know, if I listen now, it's probably trash. It's probably horrible.
You can send it to me. Let's.
Oh man,
I'll be the judge of that. Okay, so how do you get the music to Tim?
So I met, what's his name? With this, I was working with an R&B group in their house, and you know, would still be making tracks on my own, and I just rounded up a 30-track CD of beats, and it was this one kid named SOB who I gave the, he was an artist, but he knew someone named Larry Live who was Tim's best friend. And through Larry Live, SOB through Larry, they got it to Tim. So he took it to Larry.
Did you know that's where it was going?
I did not know. He just was like, you know, I know somebody who knows Tim. And I just gave it to him like, okay, you know. I think at this point, I have made a few runs to New York. Like, I was very busy out of high school. Like, as far as trying to get on and trying to make it in the industry. Like, I was moving around. So I gave him a CD. By then, I've already had a good amount of disappointment, so I didn't even, whatever. Gave him CD. CD got to Tim. Word get back to me. Tim wants to meet. I meet Tim at a music symposium that was happening in Virginia. And my first meeting with Tim. That's my brother. I love Tim. Tim was so grumpy and was like, I don't know how this can even happen, but he was just like, you hot, but in the most grumpiest way. So I didn't know how to even take that.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, nodded at me like, yo, you dope. That was it. I went home. I understand. He was back in Virginia. I wouldn't want to be in Virginia either. You know, especially if I've been out and I've been doing my thing. I wouldn't have wanted to be there. So I get it. So phone call later that night, I believe it was that night. Larry called me, or Esso called me. One of them called me. He was like, yo, meet at Larry's house. Can you come to his house? Tim want to talk. So that's when I talked to Tim for like 2 hours the very first time. And he was just telling me everything he had going on and potentially what I could bring to the table and come work with me in L.A. And I'm skipping some details, but by then I didn't have the first management. I had I was in another situation, and it didn't work out. That first meeting with Tim didn't work out. But that was my first conversation where he kind of acknowledged my talent. And for real, no grumpiness. He was, you know, had a better mood. And that was just an accomplishment because that's the guy I was, like, gunning for since I was 15, 16 years old. Like,
and you were only probably 19 at that point.
Yeah, 19, 20 at that point.
That's so young.
Yeah, it was. When I look back and look at the timeline, like, it felt like forever.
Sure.
You know, but it was, all this stuff happened, like.
Did you know anything about the business?
Zero.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Were you already called Danger at the time?
At the time, yeah.
When did you get that name?
That name, all right, should I give you the real story?
No, I want the real story.
I kind of want the real story first, and then
I want you to have to tell the story that you tell
like,
other people.
You know, like the Joker, he tells a new story every time about his car. Yeah. That's how I do about my name. So, the real story, and I told this story recently, the real story is my first name was Supernova. There was some kid who claimed that his name was that as well in Virginia. I don't even know how this got communicated to me, but I'm like, okay, well, if that's your name, okay, cool. Let me find out something else, figure out something else. So I remember writing down just a bunch, just trying to come up with something else. I just wrote down a few different things. And I love Danger, and I put the hands together, but I really only did that because I wanted the syllables to sound like Timbaland.
Mm.
So Danger Hands, Timbaland. I just wanted the same feeling, you know what I mean? Then years later, I dropped the hands and just became. But that's the real story. I just wanted the feeling like.
It's so crazy to want one specific human on the entire planet to pay attention.
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
I can't even believe it even now.
When you went home and told your siblings and your parents that you're going by Danger Hands, how much shit did they give you?
You know,
or did they just start saying, okay, Danger.
Yeah, they just kind of roll with it, you know? And then all my
Danger
brothers.
Danger dinner.
Right, right.
Man. Mom.
I don't think they don't. You know what's funny is I call my mom sometimes and she'll answer me. She'll answer like, Danger. I'm like, come on, man. I don't even like to introduce myself
as Danger. Bag, man.
And my mom, is calling me Danger. But, it's like later on, obviously, with success, they just accepted what it was. And...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is brought to you by CSAC, an industry leader and innovator in music performance licensing. For over 80 years, CSAC has established strong relationships in the entire community by investing in the careers of its top-tier affiliated songwriters, film, and TV composers. CSAC uses a selective and partnership approach with its affiliates, maintaining a small base, which enables them to deliver a high level of responsiveness and service. CSAC is also proud of its long history serving music users throughout the country and now represents over 1 million songs across all genres of music, as well as music from hit movies, television shows, and sporting events. CSAC is more than just a PRO and has expanded its business into additional rights categories and markets. They are also building a global licensing platform through a joint venture, Mint Digital Services. To learn more about CSAC and its relationships with affiliated songwriters and composers, visit csac.com/origins. How did you get connected to Teddy Riley?
How did that happen? Okay, so now...
Because that's in between...
That's before Tim. So
that's
it's like
before,
at the same kind of at the same time.
Because that's a huge name too. To then just people are obviously discovering what you're doing, which means that you're also putting out an insane amount of output. Because again, if you're talking about that era, there isn't a way to just stream. There's not even LimeWire or Naps or any of that at that time. Like that means people are talking behind your back about what you're doing musically, which is how music was heard for. The 150,000 years before the internet. So, whatever you're doing is clearly it's, going around. But how do you get to Teddy Riley?
Okay, I was working with the R&B group in Virginia, a local group called Natural Blend. And we just formed a bond. I met Leon Silvers. That's how this happened. Leon Silvers, who was an artist and producer, Charlemagne in the 70s, and he's also a big guy. And I was introduced to him through a friend of mine who, again, another guy who's starting record labels and publishing companies and whatever in Virginia. He's a little bit more established than the guy that I first met. And I just began to go around and he would bring me into his studio and, you know, he would listen to my music and he thought it was interesting. And he had a relationship with Teddy. And I don't necessarily, I think I went with him, but I was really working with his group. And we was just doing a lot of records and became really close friends. And they were signed, they through Leon, was signed to Teddy. And that's how I ended up in Teddy's studio. But I didn't, it wasn't a mentor thing.
Yeah.
It was just, I was just there.
I was just
in there and got the opportunity to see flashes of him work, hear things before they would come out, see a real studio for the first time, you know, walk in the studio and see a big Michael Jackson Dangerous plaque, the 20 million,
stupid.
You know, as soon as you walk in. So you just like, well, you know, where am I? And he heard some music. He, you know, he thought it was good. But it was like, I've been that guy where I'm so busy in the studio, I'm just overlooking whoever's around me in my own studio. And I understood that. So I wasn't there to work with him. But he still gave us a shot. So one of the guys in the group, he said, yo, produce this record for me. Take Michael Jackson, YY, and flip it or whatever. So that's how I ended up on the Backstreet project that came out then. I think it's Backstreet Level 2 or something like Blackstreet Level 2, I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how that happened, through Leon Silvers and the group, and they had a relationship with Teddy, and I ended up in Future Studios.
So you meet Tim after that, and you have that conversation. What brings, you know, he says you should come to L.A. That's an easy thing to say. It's another thing to go from Virginia Beach at 19, 20 years old, 21 years old, whatever it is, and then actually make a move to L.A.
Yeah.
How does it go from a conversation to you moving to L.A.?
It was a real thing. And the guys I was working with at the time, I brought it to them, and they just wasn't willing to do any type of negotiation or business with him at that time. And that opportunity slipped through the cracks, and I was devastated, of course. Like, felt like all this, you know, this 4 or 5 years I've been working, which when I look back, I was fresh out of high school. It was only 2 years out of high school. But all of this time from being inspired by this guy to meeting him and him inviting me into his world of making music, and it goes the opposite direction. You know, I was like, this, okay, this is the end. So I felt like so we ended up meeting again 2 years later, but that 2 years felt like 10 years. And I didn't expect to meet him again, but it kind of happened through the same guys. They called me up like, yo, Tim is working on a project. Can you do something that sounds like them? And we'll take it to Tim. So I was just like, you know, got the spark back again. I went back in the studio and started cooking up things that I felt like, I mean, there were things that he was already doing, but, you know, my own way. By then, my musicality had developed to a whole nother level. And I took it to him and played it for him on his tour bus. And this summer, this same summer that I played it for him on his tour bus, was a very interesting summer because I met a lot of people that summer. So I played it for him on his tour bus in Virginia. He happened to be in Virginia. And I remember he played the tracks and he literally skipped through the tracks. He didn't even listen to them, like 3 seconds. He listened to 3 seconds. And it wasn't a bad skip. It was just like he heard enough in that 3 to 5 seconds to know where the track was going to be excited enough to go to the next. He was just like, it's crazy. Like, that's crazy. Like, I'm just like, you know, I didn't even let the beat drop. Like, let it drop. And he was just like, you know, it kind of brought that spark back for him, I guess, to know that, okay, he didn't fall off or it wasn't a fluke. And that was it. I didn't hear anything from him for the rest of that summer. And then I got a call back from him in, like, December to work with him in Miami. And that was, like, the start of it.
Did you have a cell phone at the time? Yeah, I guess we would have just gotten cell phones.
I just was really carrying a cell
phone. Just like getting a cell phone, you get a phone call, and it's some random number from, he was in Miami at the time?
He was in Miami.
Yeah.
Or moving from Miami, maybe back.
But you get this LA. Call, you probably didn't even know who it was from.
No, I didn't know. I think somebody hit me like, yo, Tim gonna call you. Answer the phone.
How fast can I get to wherever you are?
Right.
What was the first thing, you know, when you walk in the studio and he's there and it's like, okay, this is our chance to work together. One, how nervous were you? Or were you just like, I'm not nervous, I'm just ready to play?
Yeah, I was just ready, man. I wasn't nervous. I was just ready to work. It was some nerve. Let me not lie. It was some nerve, but it was just
it's
like
exciting, nervous.
It was exciting, right? Because it was just like, it wasn't like, I hope I don't blow it. I was just like, all right, this is it, and we actually about to collaborate on a track. And he had his studio on the bus, and I went on the bus. He played some beats, and I played some stuff, and put some stuff together, and that's how we started it. He was working on an artist. He had a new artist named John Doe. And he was a rapper. So that was kind of the first thing we dove in to create for. And we did a lot of stuff together for his project. So our, like, chemistry, obviously it developed and turned into what it had turned into, but instantly it was already like, you know, I felt like we was already talking the same language for years. We just didn't know.
Yeah.
And when we got together, I feel like we just understood each other. I think I was giving him an original musician's take and a freshness with his beats, and it just went from there. So it allowed me to, I didn't have to worry about drums and different things with him, and he didn't have to worry about melody. We just held each other down in that way.
Yeah, so nuts. You know, you start getting cuts around this time that start really reacting in some capacity before the Justin Timberlake stuff. But, you know, it's a lot of cuts, a lot of songs out there, but it's really, I feel like even the Lloyd Banks stuff on the side, whatever, but it's the Game record to me that's sort of the first really big, you know, that's really the album that defines the Game. It would be, you know, sort of changes what rap is at that time. I feel like that might be, and I, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but this is sort of the first song that, the first kind of album that people at home must know about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a different level. It's not even that everyone at home knows who, well, maybe everyone in your home knows who Timbaland is because of the connection, but that just feels like a different level.
Yeah.
How did it feel for you to go from aspiring, and then, you know, becomes like the biggest rapper of that year?
I mean, I don't know. It's like being in that moment with him during that time, we were just locked in the Hit Factory, and we was just working on whatever he had came through. So with the Lloyd Banks success and a couple other things we worked on, I think by that time we might have did something with Justin, not for his album, but for the, like, a movie or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like, you know, another day.
Yeah.
But what was exciting about it was that obviously it's coming from Dr. Dre, which all of us, everybody is like, you know, we got a message to send. Yeah. So Tim, the way that thing came about is Tim was like, he would tell me, yo, we got this tonight, da 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 da. And I would start creating, like, right then. So I was creating in the house. I did, like, 3 tracks. Went to the studio and played the tracks. And, you know, he had heard something. You know, he liked something because his eyes would bulk up. And he just was like, okay. So he had went on the tour bus. And he came back in the bus with that damn thing. And, you know, that's when we added together and did things together. But the bones of it, he came back off that bus into the studio with that thing. And it was crazy. And the Game came in and killed it. And I guess he sent it to Dre. And that's when we know, once we got the approval over there.
So now you're still in your 20s. Yeah, and you're I'm working with Tim. The Jerry's likes your work. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
And then you have obviously Black Eyed Peas and Genuine and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even that Black Eyed Peas album.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid.
Yeah, my style.
But it's, you know, there's the level of success where you're working on hit albums, and then there's the one where you have a string of actual hits. And that's really the Justin Timberlake stuff, obviously, mm-hmm. you know. And Sexy Back is the song that really defines sort of, in a way, you know, it's a new era for Tim because of the connection you guys are making. Right. How did it feel, one, to start hearing your songs everywhere? everywhere. You still hear them. That era, is just, you're just hearing them everywhere.
Right. It was...
There's now going to be a 3 or 4 year period where you can't go anywhere without hearing a song of yours.
Yeah.
You're having coffee, you're going to hear it. Breakfast, everywhere. You're going to hear it. Anywhere you go.
I mean, it's so funny. Like, we was in New York working a couple weeks ago. And every time I walked into the gym, like on my birthday was the 22nd. We in the gym. I walk in the gym. Sexy Back comes on. So I'm in there just flinging the towel. You know, it's my birthday. It's like, you know what I mean? It's crazy. It's just, we were working with Justin. So it was just like, I've came a long way. You know, that was just a reminder of how, you know, I'm full circle back in the studio with this guy right now. I'm in the gym. They playing a song we did who knows how many years ago at this point. But that time, like, it was like, the first thing off the boat was Promiscuous. And, no, I think Man Eater was out before Promiscuous. So Man Eater was out, and it was doing well overseas.
Oh, that's all the same year.
That's all the same time, yeah.
Oh, man.
And then, Promiscuous came. And Promiscuous was, was a hit or hitting. Then Sexy Back came. And... yeah, by then, I'm just like, I don't know what's going on. I had no idea what was happening. Tim knew. Obviously, he had massive hit records. He didn't have any of that caliber, but he knew what having back-to-back records feel like and things like that. But now we're doing it in a pop space. And I didn't understand. Like, I didn't understand. I was just kind of riding the momentum. And just kept my head down, really working. Like, I didn't really think about, I didn't get caught up in, I got number one record, I'm the man, and whatever. I was just like, well, how can I secure the next one?
Were you able to enjoy any of it, or were you just constantly?
I feel like I did, yeah. I feel like I enjoyed the whole ride. But, you know, a lot of work and a lot of opportunity comes with that, so... for me,
yeah, the opportunity is the part that really changes everything.
Right.
Because you're like, well, now this door is open. I got to go in the studio here. I got to go there. And
so I felt more of a pressure to deliver than actually, you know, enjoying the success of the records. And
it's a guy in his 20s it's a
20.
You're barely developed as a human, you know.
25 maybe at the time. 24, 25 by the time this stuff started hitting.
It takes so long to get paid as a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
upfront at least for a producer. Right. And if Tim's getting paid as a producer, mm-hmm. then that money's coming way before.
Right.
You know, this had to be the first time you're seeing any sort of money that's like this.
Yeah, this was before then I did my publishing deal, but I don't think any of us knew before. We did it a year. We did it at the same time that we was working on these things. So I probably got a little bit better deal than a new songwriter, and my deal was at Warner. But we had no idea what was coming, right? So obviously, knowing what I know now, if I could have borrowed $50,000 from somebody to hold me down, like, I would have never did a co-pub deal. But these things came. So I had a little cushion by the time this stuff started hitting. So. Yeah. But once it hit, like, you know, from productions, I was making a lot of money just from advances on productions.
Yeah, that's an era where people are when all of us top liners would get these you know, phone calls of, we got a hit, we just need a top line. Right, you're right. Like, whoa, you mean like you need a song?
Yeah.
You're sending me, but people like you would send these beats to everyone's like, this is a smash. Mm-hmm. You're like, there's nothing on it. Mm-hmm. It's insane. Yeah. You know, so they were willing to pay you guys, like, because you guys had...
Yeah.
You guys were giving hits, but there was no, not even a song. They were paying you. Like, this, the hit was already going to, it was inevitable.
Right, right. So from just production, that was also still cool. But then once, you know, obviously it takes, you know, 6-9 months, maybe a little more for you to see your residuals when things are out. And, you know, obviously when that came in, you see, like, okay, this is what we did. Like, okay, I didn't know that any of this was coming from that. But okay, now I understand.
What did your family feel about that? Because there's a difference in being able to hear a song, and then there's this moment when people realize the value of these songs that are not you. You know, where mm-hmm. they're. Did that change any of your relationships with anybody, for better or for worse? You know, seeing someone be so successful. You were at the very top of an industry, so I just imagine people are pulling at you, not even if they're your family, just randoms.
My family was cool, and of course they would ask for different things, and you know, but other than that, they were excited. You know, they were happy for me and proud, and still very proud. And I don't even know if they noticed the whole full scope of what I've been through. Mm. I would have to really sit and tell them, like, this is how my life went since you first heard this song. And hopefully I get the opportunity to really...
You're saying right now?
I'm saying right now, I don't even think they really understand.
What would you tell them?
I would just go start from the beginning and just say, look, this is how the music business worked for me. And when those records came out, this is how my life changed. And these are the things, the conversations I had, the places I've been, the people I've worked with. They see the things that come out, and they, you know, they don't ask me too much. They just kind of take it as it goes. I think that's always been how it was since the beginning. I would be off trying to meet someone or get on or do what I had to do, but they never really asked questions. I think one thing I feel blessed about is my parents had a trust in me to know that I wasn't going to just be out there wherever I am, you know, jacking up my opportunity or harming myself or being unhealthy or into drugs or, you know what I'm saying? They just trusted me as an adult. I feel like I gained that trust from being an independent teenager. And they just let me do my thing, and I just come back home and maybe tell them if they ask. I'm like a... I don't volunteer information. But if you ask me, I would tell you anything you want to know. But we just kept it really... Which I can appreciate to some degree. It wasn't... They didn't ask me too many questions. They might say, what do you got? What are you working on now? And it would probably be... It'll stop there. But I'm glad that I didn't have all these deep dive conversations in the business and questions when I go home, because that's the last place I want to deal with that. So yeah, I think at this point I probably owe them a conversation of like, look, I don't know if y'all really know who I am. I know y'all know I'm your son, but this is what I've done. Break it down.
They probably love that.
Yeah.
Did you have any life outside of music?
Such as?
I don't know. You're in your 20s and you have the biggest songs in the world.
I mean...
I think in my 20s, I wanted to have the biggest songs in the world. I did not have the biggest songs in the world. That took me many years after that. So I was like, at that... You know, and it's easy to glorify it, but I always think, oh man, if I would have had that success in my 20s, for sure I would have just been an idiot about
it. Oh, yeah. I say that all the time, that anybody...
And you're in Miami.
Yeah, anybody who had my success and access would have blown the whole thing. But again, I was so dead set on development personally from as a producer. And I didn't bury, I mean, I worked a lot, but yes, I would go out to the strip club. I would go out to a club. I would go to dinner. I would have little vacations here and there, and, you know, but I kept myself out of trouble primarily. I mean, I'm single. I'm not married. I don't have any children. One day, when I feel it's right, but, you know, I don't know. You know,
hey, man,
I mean?
You're young.
Yeah.
So you start, one of the coolest things about your discography is that you never seemed to get pigeonholed, or you never chose to, you weren't like, I do, you know, I do rap beats, I do pop, I do whatever. I mean, you have Bjork and Simple, this next year, Bjork and then Simple Plan and then Duran Duran.
Right.
You know, you have 50 Cent, you have Cascade. This is all in the next year. Danity Kane, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all over the place. Do you view that you change what you do depending on who's in the room, or are you always yourself?
I think myself is versatility. I think that is who I am. Going back to what I was saying when I was working with a lot of different artists at a young age, that helped me to become this guy who can stretch into anything. Even though it's primarily R&B and hip hop, it was still different styles of R&B and different styles of hip hop. So I was, even then, just very versatile. But yeah, I do change it a little bit depending on who I'm working with or what I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I'm not the guy who's trying to put my identity on your music. I'm an artist producer. I'm looking at the artist and whatever the picture they want to paint and the story they want to tell, I'm going to help them develop that picture. Like, okay, I think I understand what you want to do. How does this work? And that's pretty much it. Like, I'm not gonna work with Celine or Adele and put her on Promiscuous.
Right.
Like, I'm
right. You're gonna write the right.
Yeah, I'm gonna write the right record. It might have some edge and some style, but it's gonna feel right for her. It's not gonna feel like, why is she on that? You know, I've heard that before.
But one of the things, and I mentioned it in the beginning, was, you know, the Blackout, that album for Britney was totally revolutionary certainly for her. But it was a big change from where, you know, the late 90s pop went for some of those people. But it was the appropriate kind of music for her that kind of reflected what Justin was doing, right. You know? And to do Give Me More on that, I was saying that every time you hear a vocal chop, it always feels like that's like the first like big hit, right? That feels like it had a vocal chop. Where did you get that from? You're just playing around and just...
I mean, we were playing around, but those are things, the way we would edit and chop the beats, we was doing that for years already.
Yeah.
So we would be in the studio chopping up vocals and chopping up beats before that. So it was just, that's why after Give Me More, you probably never really heard me do it again, because I think that was like it for me.
It got so big.
Yeah,
that
it was like, there's no need to do that style of production again as far as chopping and editing.
As you keep going, you obviously start working with, I mean, you've worked with Mariah and Madonna, and I think there's like six people maybe on the planet you didn't work with during this time. Snoop and Missy and Busta and MIA and just Whitney. Come on. Mm-hmm. When you weren't working with Tim during this, did you guys get used to working together so much in the studio that you depended on each other, or was it nice when you guys produced separate from each other?
So the last project we did together was up until Say Something with Justin and Man of the Woods was Madonna. And we did 4 minutes, and we did a few other records on that together. I don't think we dependent on each other at all. And I still feel like we can jump back in at any moment and just lock back in. Like, mm-hmm. that's just something we develop. But no, I don't feel like at all we missed anything. Because my style is my style.
Yeah.
His is his. And when we come together, that's when it becomes, you know, Voltron is formed and that's what that becomes. But uniquely and individually, we have our own.
Totally.
Own thing.
Just shout out to Knock You Down as just an amazing record.
Thank you.
There aren't that many songs that you just wish you wrote. That's such a good record. How does a writer not burn out? With the amount of material you're creating that it at any time, but how do you not burn out? Did you ever burn out?
No, I don't think I burnt out, but I think I lost perspective on what I wanted to create. I definitely went through that. Like, I would say, so there was a time period where my studio was being built in Florida. And that would probably be like my most quiet years because it just got to a point with the business that they wasn't trying to be paying booking studio and all these other things that I might have been used to up until that point. So it just came down to like, let me just build my own thing. And during that time period, I was searching, like, you know, a lot of things that I felt like I kind of predicted how music was going to go, and I would try to be on that curve. And either I was too far ahead and it didn't work, or a tad bit too late. So I just went through a period, maybe two years of just trying to figure out sonically what I wanted. I was in between. It was a lot of things. Like, I was just in between how I wanted things to sound and what felt good to me. And even creatively, like, music hit a weird place. Like, it wasn't this synthesized, super electric thing, which wasn't the only thing that I did, but that changed. It was just a lot of development, a lot of changes in music in totality. So it just took me a minute to, let me figure out what I want to do that. Because I'm always thinking to break ground. Like, what is going to change something and move and push the needle?
What would push the needle now?
When
there's so much music out there, what do you think pushes the needle in 2020?
You know what? I think my approach now more than anything is having a great song. That's what pushes the needle. If the song has to be outstanding and the music bed is whatever, but if the song is amazing, the song is just a vehicle for whatever sound you create. So we can mix and match and put all types of things together. And if the top line isn't right, it doesn't matter. So it can be a great top line on the stupidest, silliest beat.
Still
and
a song.
It'd be, you know, yeah. It come down to that. Come down to what people are singing along to. So I've switched my focus. My focus has gone more to trying to construct the best song possible. And, you know, it's difficult for me because I'm not necessarily a lyricist. So to be able to stick with songwriters and collaborators that I feel like are delivering what I feel like is a great song all the time is tough.
Who are those people?
I'm still discovering those people.
Yeah.
I have a lot of people that I work with that I continue to. It's a lot of new people all the time. I feel like every time I come to LA or I go to Nashville, I'm working with a different group of people. And I'm like, Nashville was awesome because their whole thing is surrounded by just making a good song. Like, I go in and play some chords. They're going to write a song, go home at the end of the day, a full song that's pretty strong lyrically and melodically.
Yeah, it means something.
Yeah. And then I can go home and do whatever production I want to do, which is, yes, it matters, but it not so much because the song is great. And I have good enough taste to not mess up a good song with some eclectic production.
Yeah. The, you know, it's, I mean, this would take us another 6 interviews to go through all of the songs, but having worked with royalty like Beyonce and Jay-Z on the DJ Khaled record, mm-hmm. you know, getting through I mean, it's really just kind of everybody. Who are some pop people that you, or not even pop people, who are some writers that you, artists that you wish you would write with?
Man, I would love to work with Adele. I had my Adele moment and I blew it, but.
Why? What happened?
You know what? She came in the studio. It was nothing against her. She was beautiful. It was when I was in London. This was like before 21. So I was in London and we worked a day. And we might have had 2 days scheduled. We worked. She came in with this insane thing. And she kind of got on the mic and started singing it, and I was going to try to produce around it, and it wasn't finished. And, you know, we went, I would say, a normal studio day, and we were going to, you know, call it quits. And the next day got canceled. So I'm like, maybe I messed up. I don't know. But I didn't think until later on maybe I messed up when I heard the song that we did in the studio. And that song happened to be Rolling in the Deep.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, I know that melody from somewhere. Because I remember how she sung it a cappella. So she already had it written. So I was going to try to produce around it. And she sung that thing, and I was blown back. And then, you know, months later, probably later that year, I hear that same melody come out. And I'm just like, God, that's that song we was doing in the studio. Like, that's my song.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So I'm like, oh my God, I blew my chance to probably have one of the biggest songs of that time. Like, so that was it. You know, I would love to work with her. Beyonce, I still want my Beyonce shot. Like, even though, you know, those records were done through Khaled, and yeah. I've been in the studio with her on two different occasions. And almost made it. I forgot which album it was. It was the album that had Who Runs the World, Girls, with the Diplo joint. Almost made it on that one. Didn't quite make it. And
there's for down sure people listening to this that know how to get you closer to Beyonce.
I hope
camp.
So. Beyonce. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Beyonce. We got to do it. We got to do it for real.
Yeah, I mean, you end up with other Beyonce records because you have something this last year with Lion King and stuff like that. So, I mean, so crazy. Just the fact that you get to keep working a lot with these artists throughout their career, the Justin Timberlakes, and being able to have being part of the whole arc of their career, it's sort of ninja level where it's, you know, it's one thing where you try to get a song on an album. It's another thing when you have try to get an album and a career. Then it's another thing when you try to get multiple albums and a career and be part of that. It's really cool, man. Into our next segment, let's go for five for five. I'm going to name five people and just tell me the first thing that comes off the top of your head, okay? Let's start with Justin Timberlake.
Genius.
We didn't talk about it, but I know you did actually work on it. Let's go with The Weeknd.
The Weeknd, the SZA record?
Is that what it was? Is that the name of the song?
Yeah,
that
was a sample.
That was a SZA record.
Yes, they sampled.
She's so good.
Yeah.
I like the name.
She's amazing too.
Yeah. Let's go with Timbaland.
Timbaland is the greatest creative mind in the last 100 years.
Wow.
We ain't even heard what he's capable of. If you go through that man's drive and listen to some of that weird stuff, you'd be like, how? I thought I was weird, but he's, greatest creative mind in the last 100 years. One of the greatest.
Let's go with Britney Spears.
There's so much I want to say.
You can say more than one. There aren't really any rules to it, I promise you.
Oh, my God. First of all, I'm thankful for that opportunity more than anything, like, to be able to be completely free creatively on that on that project. And she, you know, welcomed us in her home and, you know, let us make magic. So, grateful. That's my Britney, grateful.
Let's go with Let's go with Virginia Beach.
Home. Regardless of what I dislike about my own town, I hope I get the opportunity to create places where people can have an opportunity to develop their talent. You know, that's a big goal and big dream of mine, to have a place in Virginia Beach where kids can go and develop and discover things about themselves that they might not know they have in them. Because I think what my parents did for me was put things in front of me to let me figure it out. You know, I used to sketch and draw. I used to, you know, they'd give me sketch pads, keyboards, piano, whatever it was to help me, you know, basketball, whatever it was to help me discover and develop my creativity, that's what they did for me. So I feel like that was the major difference, is having someone to put things in front of you. You know, I want these place to, I want these kids to come to a place where they can check in at the front, grab a camera, start snap. Maybe they love taking photos. Maybe they love taking videos and video. They don't know. So a lot of kids don't know. So Virginia Beach is a gold mine. It's a mine where there are diamonds that needs to be chiseled away, and I gotta like put a place out there for people to help figure that out for themselves.
Yeah, the last one I was gonna say was your father.
My father, man. I mean, both of my parents, they showed me an equal amount of love and attention and space and freedom. And I think if anything I can do is make them proud, or as proud as I possibly can, show, you know, be a respectable human being to reflect what they've, you know, put in me as a child. So, you know, nothing but love and gratitude and inspiration forever, and the best example. They are the best example of anything, of everything. They are the best example. Even because they're still together in relationship and married and everything. So from marriage to parenting to how to treat people, they are the best example of everything. So I have them as my example of how to be as a human being.
Well, thank you for doing this.
No problem.
When you describe how you would listen to Timbaland, just how does he do that? I know when I started writing for other people, and I was starting to get these tracks, and I was in a band, and people were sending tracks, and it was always, you know, trying to write a hit song, whatever that might be. Most of my stuff was just trash, mm-hmm. You know? But I just remember the biggest song was, you know, that Blackout album, and having Give Me More, and I was out here in L.A., and I was just like, I don't know how this is done. I don't have any idea. I mean, I'm a band guy trying to write songs, and I don't know how this is done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that makes you a better musician, is when you don't know how it's done. It's not a matter of, it's not a business thing. It's not, oh, I want that success. Right. That has nothing to do mm-hmm. with it. It has to do with the actual, how does that song actually, in a compositional sense, work?
Right.
And just remember just studying that album and trying to learn how to write a hit song the way that these people are writing hit songs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to sit here for me, having, you know, hearing you talk about being inspired by other people, mm-hmm. and it's like, man, you were a big inspiration. So man, I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you.
And yeah, thanks,
thank
man.
No,
excited
thank
to hear
me.
The next chapters, man.
Yeah, man, it's going to be exciting. And yeah, we need to do this again. It's so much more to this story.
Oh, I know. And that's look, I promise you, as we keep going, where it's that's the idea, is to just be able to keep revisiting.
Yeah,
revisiting.
we're gonna have a part two for sure.
Yeah, I love it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you wanna hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.